God, where to begin? It's such a big topic. And he's such a controversial figure, Aleister Crowley, you know. And people tend to fall into two camps around Crowley. They're either people who think he's amazing and a God figure, and up to the extent of modelling themselves on him, or he's seen as this kind of devil figure. And people are frightened of him. I remember my friend Sue Render, who runs Labyrinth Books. She had an assistant working in a shop who she found hiding all the Crowley books in the shop. And given she's an occult bookshop, there's quite a lot of books, really, because she was frightened of the evil energies that were coming off the books. Now,
okay, I probably need Crowley for what's the word? Beginners.
I'm gonna do that.
I know nothing about him whatsoever.
Well, in a way, that's an advantage, really, if you're not heard. Well, Aleister Crowley basically died in 1947. So basically, he was born in the late 19th century, 1880s, something like that. So he was about 60. Maybe a bit earlier than that. So he's a kind of Victorian figure, late 19th century to the earliest 20th century. He dies in 1947. He is one of the people involved in the occult revival in the UK. But he also, because he's quite a publicist, he acquired a reputation in the papers because of his spiritual beliefs for being the wickedest man in the world. Let me just stop for a moment. So he was a Kabbalist. He was somebody who was part of this organization called the Golden Dawn, out of which people like Dion Fortune and then later my own teacher Ernest Butler arose. Now, they weren't part of the Golden Dawn, but what you see happening in the 19th century is in common with this whole interest in as sort of science and different kinds of spirituality start to come into the West again. There's an upsurge of interest in things like the Kabbalah, in alchemy, and in traditions that work with the deep imagination, there's a group of people, mostly kind of Freemasons, but women as well, who get together and form this occult society called the Order of the Golden Dawn, and they are interested really in looking at the Kabbalah, in looking at mythology, in looking at the different ways of transforming the human spirit, just in the way that we are. It was Yeats, W.B. Yeats was a member of the Golden Dawn. It attracted quite a lot of literary interest. Aubrey Beardsley was in it at one point. Charles Williams was in a version of it. It appealed to a certain part of society who are looking for something different, who are wanting to work with a deep imagination. And so Aleister Crowley comes into that. Now, he is a man who was brought up by the Plymouth Brethren and had an incredibly hard childhood. In some ways, if we looked at the way his life was today, we would say that this was an abused child. Because of some of the things he went through. Highly intelligent, he went to Cambridge. His family were quite wealthy, so he didn't have to have a job. He was a great mountaineer. He was one of the first people to climb K2 without a guide. Because in those days they only went with guides. Brilliant chess player. But he was damaged in his relationships, really. He also used a lot of drugs. He had serial affairs and never could hold an intimate relationship together. He's a heroin addict, but his heroin addiction came about because he was prescribed heroin for his asthma, because the heroin was not a controlled drug in those days. But what he was in particular that was so challenging to Victorian society and early 20th Edwardian society when that came about was what he was public and very open about his life and about his experience. And so he acquires a sort of a reputation. So he tells people he's a magician, he tells people he practices the Kabbalah, tells people he practices drugs, tells people he practices sex magic. He, in a way, you know, if he'd been doing his thing in the 1970s, he'd have been part of a whole cultural movement where people were doing stuff like that. And he might have been thought as reprehensible or not, but he certainly wouldn't have acquired the notoriety that he required. And he's one of the quite a prolific writer on the Kabbalah, about his own particular brand of Kabbalah. As we saw, he's also created his own tarot deck. He was a teacher of Kabbalah. He created effectively his own religion, because he created a new version and something he called the Law of Thelema, which was based upon a different version of spirituality. But my own teacher, felt that he was a powerful teacher and somebody he wouldn't recommend a beginner go near Crowley, but somebody, but an experienced Kabbalist could gain a lot from working with him. I don't think Ernest knew him very well, but because Ernest was a lot younger than him, but they had come across each other. But what's happened in the sort of, since 1947, is that he's been both deified and demonized. So one of the difficult things, really, that in addressing the whole issue of Aleister Crowley, is that people have such strong reactions to him. Do I think he was a sane and balanced teacher? No, not that he wasn't that balanced, but he was profoundly creative, and his tarot pack, I honestly believe, is extraordinary. I know it's difficult, and if it doesn't work for you, that's fine, but actually it's I've worked with it for so many years, and the ideas that are built into it are profound, powerful spiritual ideas. I just want to read you a little bit of his approach, really, to the inner worlds. I'll just find the right piece. Because I just want to show you something about his thinking, as opposed
Which
to...
Book is this,
yeah? It's coming out, I'm looking at his novel Moonchild, because he does a really good description of different layers of things. I'll just find the right bit for now. I'll of course find it now. Okay. Okay, so in this is a novel called Moonchild, but his magician figure, which is really a version of himself in the book, is explaining the idea of deeper dimensions. So he's saying, I'm going to make everything as simple as I possibly can. You've got a good imagination, and I think you should be able to follow. So look here, I take a pencil and a piece of paper. I make a point, it stays there. It doesn't go in any direction. In mathematics, we say it is extended in no dimension. Now I draw a straight line. That goes in one direction. We say it is extended in one dimension. Now I make another line to cross it at right angles. That is one extension in a second dimension. So then the person he's talking to says, oh, I see, and then another line would make a third dimension. Don't go too fast. Your third line is of no use. If I want to show the position of any point on the paper, I can do it by reference to these two lines only. Make a point and I'll show you. She obeyed. Now, I draw my lines from your point to make right angles of my lines. I say your point is so far east of the central point and so far north. You see, I can determine the position by only two measurements. So then she says, but if I made my point right in the air here. Exactly. We then need a third line, but it must be at right angles to the other two. Sticking up, as you might say. Then we can measure in three directions and determine that the point is so far east, so far south, so far high. Now I'll go over it again in another way. Here is a point, not long, nor broad, nor thick, no dimension. Here is a line, long, but neither broad nor thick, one dimension. Here is a surface, long and broad, but not thick, two dimensions. Here is a solid, long, broad and thick, three dimensions. Now I quite understand, but you said four dimensions. I'll say it presently, but just now I'm going to hammer away at two. Observe, I make a triangle, all the sides are equal. Now I draw a line through it from one angle to the middle of the other side. I've got two triangles. They are exactly alike, as you see, same size, same shape, but they point in opposite directions. Now we'll cut them out with scissors. He did so. Slide them about so that one lies exactly to cover the other. She tried and failed, and with a laugh turned one over when it easily fitted. Ah, you cheated, I said. Slide them. I'm sorry. On the contrary, you've acted divinely in the best sense. You took the thing that wouldn't fit out of its world of two into the world of three, put it back, and they all lived happily ever after. The next thing is this. Everything that exists, everything material, has these three dimensions. These points and lines and surfaces have all a minute extension in some other dimension. Otherwise, they would be merely things in our imagination. The surface of water, for example, is merely the boundary between it and the air. Now, I'm going to tell you why some people have thought that another dimension might exist. These triangles, so like yet so unlike, have analogies in the world of what we call real things. For example, there are two kinds of sugar, exactly like in every way but one. You know how a prism bends a ray of light? Well, if you take a hollow prism and fill it with a solution of one of these kinds of sugar, the ray bends to the right. Here's the other kind, it bends to the left. Chemistry is full of these examples. Then we have our hands and feet. However we move them about, we can never make them fill exactly the same place. A right hand is always a right hand, however you move it. It only becomes a left hand in a looking glass. So your mirror should in future afford you a superior sort of reflection. It should remind you that there is a looking glass world if only you could get through. Yes, but we can't get through. Don't let us lose the way. Enough to say that there might be such a world. But we must try to find a reason for thinking there is one. Now, the very best reason of all is a very deep one, but we must try to understand it. We know that the planets move at certain rates in certain paths, and we know that the laws which govern them are the same at which made Newton's apple fall. But Newton couldn't explain that law, and he said he found himself quite unable to imagine a force acting at a distance as gravitation, so-called, appears to do. Science was hard put to it and had to finally to invent a substance called the ether, of which there was no evidence, only it must be there. But this ether had so many contradictory and impossible qualities that people began to cast about for some other explanation. And it was found that by supposing an extension of the universe, thin but uniform, in a fourth dimension, that the law would hold good. I know it's hard to grasp this idea, but let me put it to you this way. Take this cube. Here is a point, a corner, where the three bounding lines join. The point is nothing, yet it is part of the lines. To imagine it at all as a reality, we must say that it has a minute extension in these lines. Now take a line. It has a similar, minute, uniform extension in the two surfaces which it bounds. Take the surface. It is similarly part of the one cube. Go one step further. Imagine that the cube is related to some unknown thing, as the surface is to the cube. You can't? True, you can't make a definite image of it, but you can form an idea, and you can. And if you train yourself to think of this very hard, presently you will get a little closer to it. I'm not going to bother you much longer with this dry theoretical part. I'll only just tell you that a fourth dimension, besides explaining the difficulties of gravitation and some others, gives us an idea of how it is that there are only a definite fixed number of kinds of things from which all others are combined. So now he's going to show, and so now he's I'll just jump a little bit. So he's going to show this business of how appearance and reality can be different. So he asks his assistant to produce a wooden cone and a basin of water. So he takes the wooden cone in his hand and poised it over a bowl of water. We're now going to suppose that this very simple object is going to try its best to explain its nature to the surface of the water, which we will imagine as endowed with powers of observation and reasoning equal to our own. All that the cone can do is to show itself to the water, and it can only impress the water by touching it. So it dips its point thus. The water perceives a point. The cone goes on dipping. The water sees a circle around where the point was. The cone goes on. Circle gets bigger and bigger. Suddenly, as the cone goes completely through, snap. Now, what does the water know? Nothing about any cone. If it got any idea that the various commotions were caused by a single object, which it would only do if it compared them carefully, noted a regularity of rate of increase in the size of the circle, and so on, In other words, use the scientific method. It would not involve a theory of a cone, for we must remember that any solid body is to it a thing as widely inconceivable as a fourth-dimensional body is to us. So the cone would try again. This time we dip it obliquely. The water now perceives a totally different set of phenomena. There are no circles, only ellipses. Dip again, first at this angle, then at that. One way we get curious curves called parabolas. The other way, equally curious curves called hyperbolas. By this time, the water would be nearly out of its mind if it insisted on trying to refer all these absolutely different phenomena to a single cause. It might work out a geometry, our own plane geometry, in fact, and it would perhaps get an extraordinary poetic conception of a creator who manifested in his universe such marvellous and beautiful relations. It will get all kinds of fantastic theories of this creator's power, what it would never get would be the idea that all this diversity was caused by seeing disjointedly different aspects of one single, simplest thing. I purposely took the easiest case. Suppose instead of a cone, we used an irregular body. The series of impressions would seem to the water like absolute madness. Now slide your imagination up one dimension. Do you not see how parallel our situation is with the surface of the water? First impression about the universe is of a great mysterious jumble of things which come upon them without rhyme or reason, usually to smite them down. Long later, man developed the idea of connecting phenomena, at least a few at a time. Centuries elapse, he begins to perceive law, first operating in only a few matters. More centuries, some bold thinker invents a single cause, calls it God. This hypothesis leads to interminable disputes about the nature of God, which has never been settled. Science advances, we now find that all things are subject to law. There's no need of any mysterious creator in the old sense. We look for causes in the same order of nature as the effects they produce. We no longer propitiate ghosts to keep our fires burning. Now at last, I and a few others are asking whether the whole universe be not illusion in the same way as a true surface is an illusion. Perhaps the universe is a four-dimensional object or collection of objects quite sane and simple and intelligible, manifesting itself in diversity, regular or irregular, just as the cone dips into the water. And so he says, but what is this fourth-dimensional universe? Now here, this long lecture links up with a little chat about the soul and the double personality and all the rest of it. It's perfectly simple. I, the fourth-dimensional reality, am going about my business in a perfectly legitimate way. I find myself pushing through to my surface, or let us say I become conscious of my surface, the material universe, much as the cone did as it went through the water. I make my appearance with a yell. I grow, I die. These are the same phenomena of change we perceive all around us. My three-dimensional mind thinks all this is real, a history, where at most it is a geography, a partial set of infinite aspects. I say infinite, for the cone contains an infinite number of curves. Yet this three-dimensional being is actually a part of me, though such a minute one, and it rather amuses me, now I've discovered a little bit more of myself, to find that this mind thinks that he, or even yet just his body, is the one and only. So that's a little bit of Crowley's thinking about the inner worlds and about inner dimension. Now, it's a very, I mean, there's lots of, I mean, I could give you lots more examples, but why I bother with Crowley is because he has thought very profoundly and practiced very profoundly about these aspects of the deep imagination, the deep will, about the sense of different dimensions of awareness. Now, what he was like as a human being is of less interest to me. And it should be of less interest to anybody. He's dead. He was dead in 1947. But somehow, because he has been demonized and become part of... And what's happened is he's become part of collective culture. He became an image which people have either adored or demonized. So, for example, he's in... the Beatles liked him, or one of the... I think it was John who liked him, of the Beatles, and put him on the Yellow Submarine cover. And as part of the zeitgeist of the 60s and 70s. He's been a big figure in sort of spiritual circles with people, often with idiots who copy who they think he was. He wrote a very powerful he called it his auto-hagiography. Because he believed himself to be a saint, legitimately a saint, because a saint of his own church. He had a profoundly profound sense of humor, actually, which is one of the things I do actually like about him. And one of the things he's very honest about his own shadows, his own inadequacies. He talks about himself as the demon Crowley and his self-destructive nature. But he is a really good example of somebody who. Who didn't pretend to be anything other than he was. And when you actually do look at the detail of his life, yes, some people around him had bad experiences, some people around him had very good experiences. And there's a huge... he certainly would never have been the sort of person who would just want to sit at his feet and do everything he said. But actually, as a person who has enabled really the whole field of the Kabbalah to develop and to create ideas that are about transformation that still have effect, I personally believe him to be an important figure. He's certainly been an important figure in my life. I mean, I have, you know, sort of my principal teacher was Ernest Butler, and I'm very conversant with Dion Fortune's work. But in Aleister Crowley's work challenges me and tests me in a way that some of that work doesn't. And one of the things I'm finding interesting as we pursue looking at the Book of Gates together, really, is how much of the material in the Book of Gates has strong resonances with some of Crowley's writings and ideas. But one of the curious things about him, because he is this cultural figure, he's not a neutral figure. He's become almost his own archetype, both as God and devil. You know, and it's and it's interesting because and he's one of these figures who becomes part of the collective unconscious. I mean, it happened to Jung as well. I mean, people are equally fierce sometimes about Jung. You know, the people who adore Jung and kind of and can do no wrong, about the people who completely demonize him. And I think one of the curious things I think that's happened is that if I look at what he did, so what did he do? He had a couple of bad relationships. He took a lot of drugs, but he took it in a way, he didn't destroy his life. He lived a life, he didn't have to work, but he lived certainly in a creative life that produced a huge body of work. So his political views I really, really, really dislike. He was very right-wing because he was from that, you know, moneyed British establishment class. I do know a lot about the details of his life, really. I've read all the histories, which now multiply, really. There's so many biographies of Crowley that there can't be anything left to know. And it is a genuine mystery to me that he is treated as a source of all evil. And there's so many myths about him. I mean, Dennis Wheatley used to do a myth about how he conjured the great god Pan and went mad. I'm certainly conjured the great god Pan because he was quite interesting. He wrote a wonderful hymn to Pan, and certainly his interest in paganism and pagan mystery culture was very strong. But he didn't go mad. That's a total nonsense. So there's images of him as a Satanist. He was never a Satanist. There is nothing. That's just a newspaper image that people have picked up and translated and carried on with.
Can I make an observation?
Please do.
Hello. Yes. It seems to me. I mean, Crowley was a great self-publicist, and so I think he was the first example of celebrity culture and celebrity being brought down, because there was an orchestrated campaign amongst a couple of journalists, maybe from the Daily Mirror, to get him. I mean, that sort of documented. Really, he was persecuted by the papers.
Yeah, that's true, absolutely.
He became more notorious. And I mean, say what you like about the Daily Mirror, but those are the headlines that go into our popular culture.
Yeah, I know this one. And I think when you look at his writings, you see, so if you look at that piece I read out to you, how does it seem to you? What kind of a man writes that?
A thinking man.
Yeah.
It's a very rationalized approach, isn't it, in many ways? It's,
yeah.
He's still finding something, but he's definitely coming from a more rational sort of place.
Yeah, deeply thought out. I mean, he's other sides of his being where he doesn't quite do that, but this is some very reflective guy. Somebody who is really looking at how to explain to somebody how do we touch deeper dimensions and doing it step by step.
Yeah. I love that piece about the when he's talking about the that point of water, the skin of water.
Yeah.
That's what came up for me earlier.
Yeah, and I was thinking that it's interesting that happened. Yeah, yeah.
And it's come to me, that's what was leaving the rat when it was dying.
Yes.
It's that fusion of matter and life.
Yes, exactly. That's right, exactly.
And what's leaving the rat was
that
thing gone. You can't grasp.
No, that's right. And what he invites us to, and see what he invites, exactly, we can't grasp it. It enters another dimension. It's like the cone coming out of the water at that point. And so what he invites us to imagine is that our own deeper nature is exactly this, that what we know, the known as, is a small segment of something much larger. And that sense of touching into the deeper soul is something that takes away our normal sense, not just of self, but of the universe. just as the cone, as we become the cone rather than the little circle of knownness. Everything changes. We become massively expanded. Now, I just want to read you, before we finish, I just want to read you another piece which shows more of the, his heart side. Same for book Moonchild.
People can mute themselves while you read, because I think it's affecting the sound quality.
Or just mind the mics a bit. Yeah.
If you mute everyone while you read, I think it would help.
Oh, does it? Okay, fine. Okay.
Thanks.
I just will do that then. Okay. Bear with me, I'm just finding it. Thing in the garden, in the way. Okay. So in the novel, what happens is that they're in a garden, and they Cyril, who is one of the so one of the characters in the book, says we have to do something before we leave the garden. It's pretty dark, and there is a thing in the garden. Now, the thing in the garden is a malevolent being that has been projected there, and this is really about Crowley's approach to working with unbalanced energies. And So Cyril Gray is his disciple, and so there's the figure of Simon If is the deeper magician here. So Simon If says, "Oh, little brother, how long will it take you to work through this wretched business?" "I have omnipotence at my command and eternity at my disposal," smiled the boy, using Eliphas Levi's well-known formula. "I ought to explain," said Simple Simon, turning to Lisa. "This boy is a desperate magician, confined within the circle of this forest. His plan is action. He's all for magic. Give him a wand and a host of demons to control, and he's happy. For my part, I prefer the way of the Tao, and to do everything by doing nothing. I know it sounds difficult. One day I will explain. But the practical result is I lead a placid and contented life and nothing ever happens. He, on the contrary, makes trouble everywhere, excites the wrath of Turks. And worse, if I'm right, he brings about a situation where perfectly competent ladies' maids have epileptic fits, mediums endeavour to procure blood from bewitching damsels, and now there's a thing in the garden." His voice had a wail of comic disgust. "However, this is Cyril's funeral, not mine. He called me in. I must say I approve his general plan on the whole, and I can dare say much of the opposition is unavoidable. In any case, he is a magician, the principal boy in a pantomime. I merely hold a sponge, and we have to use his formula throughout, not mine. If it ends in disaster," he adds as a cheerful afterthought, "perhaps it will teach him a lesson. A Chinese god, indeed. He'd be better as a Chinese coolie smoking opium at the feet of Chang Su." Cyril Gray says, "He tells me I stand in my own way, that I love struggle and adventure, and this is weakness and not strength. This girl is in danger, quite unnecessary danger." So Cyril, "I'm going to ask my master to show you his method. You'll see plenty of mine in the next weeks, and I should like you to have a standard of comparison. Maybe you'll want to choose one day." "I'm afraid I too like danger and excitement," cried Lisa. "Simon, I'm afraid you do. However, since Brother Cyril asks it, the way of the Tao shall be trodden as far as is possible." "What would Brother Cyril do?" "Cyril, I should take the magic sword, make the appropriate symbols, invoke the divine names, and then the thing shriveled and blasted would go back to those who sent it, screaming in agony, cursing at the gods, ready to turn even on his employers that they might wail with it in torment." "One of the best numbers on the programme," said Simon If. "Now see it the other way." "Yes, if your way is better than that," cried the girl, her eyes gleaming. "It isn't my way," said the mystic, with a sudden inflection of solemnity. His voice rose in a low, monotonous chant as he quoted from the Book of the Heart, Girt with a Serpent. "I and me and mine were sitting with lutes in the marketplace of the great city, the city of the violets and the roses. The night fell, and the music of the lutes was stilled. The tempest arose, and the music of the lutes was stilled. The hour passed, and the music of the lutes was stilled. But thou art eternity and space, thou art matter and motion, and thou art the negation of all these, for there is no symbol of thee. The listeners were thrilled to the marrow of their bones, but the old man merely gathered a handful of dittany leaves from the chased golden box where they were kept and led the way to the garden. It was very dark. Nothing could be distinguished but the outlines of the shrub and the line of the fence. "Do you see the thing?" said If. Lisa strained her eyes. "You mustn't look for anything very definite," said the mystic. "It seems that the darkness was somewhat different in that corner," said Lisa at last, pointing. "Sort of reddish tinge to the murk." "Oh, dear me, if you will use words like murk, I'm afraid you're all on Cyril's side. Look now." He put his hand on her head. With the other, he offered her the dittany. "Chew one of these leaves," he said. She took one of the silver-grey leaves with its delicate snow bloom between her teeth. "I can see a sort of shapeless mass, dark red," she said after a pause. "Now watch," cried If. He took several steps into the garden and raised his right hand. "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law," he proclaimed in such a voice as once shook Sinai. Then he threw the rest of the dittany in the direction of the thing. "By all the powers of the pentagram," shouted Cyril Grey. "He's deliberately making a magical link between it and Lisa." He bit his lip and cursed himself in silence. He knew he had been startled out of prudence. Simon If had not noticed the outburst. He quoted the book of the law. "Be strong," he cried. "Enjoy all things of sense and rapture. There is no god that shall deny thee for these." The thing became coherent. It contracted slightly. Lisa could now see that it was an animal of the wolf type, couchant. The body was as big as that of a small elephant. It became quite clearly visible. It was a dull, fiery red. The head was turned towards her, and she was suddenly shocked to see it had no eyes. The old man advanced towards it. He had abandoned his prophetic attitude. His whole gait expressed indifference, no forgetfulness. He was merely a quiet old man taking an evening stroll. He walked right into the thing. Suddenly, as it enveloped him, Lisa saw that a faint light was issuing from his body, a pale phosphorescent which kindled warmly as he went. She saw the edges of the thing contract, as if they were sucked inwards. This proceeded and the light became intense. About a burning ovoid core dawned and vibrated the flashing colours of the rainbow. The thing disappeared completely. At the same moment the light went out. Simon If was once again merely an old gentleman taking an evening stroll. But she heard a soft voice, almost as faint as an echo. It murmured, "Love is the law, love and a will." "Let's go in," he said. "You must not," as he rejoined him, "you must not catch a chill." "Let me explain," said a simple Simon. "If everyone did his will, there would be no collision. Every man and woman, every woman is a star. Now, when we get off our orbits, it is when we get off our orbits that the clashes come. Now, if a thing gets off its orbit and comes into my sphere of attraction, I absorb it as quietly as possible and the stars sing again." "But weren't you in great danger from that devilish thing?" asked Lisa. "The rhinoceros," quoted Simon If, "finds no place in him in which to thrust its horn, nor the tiger a place in him to fix its claws, nor the weapon in him a place to admit its point. And for what reason? Because there is in him no place of death." "But you did nothing. You were just acting like an ordinary man. I didn't think it would be death for anyone but you." "An ordinary man would not have touched a thing. It was on a different plane and would no more have interfered with him than sound interferes with light. A young magician, one who had opened a gate onto that plane but had not yet become master of that plane, might have been overcome. The thing might have even dispossessed his ego and used his body as his own. This is the beginner's danger in magic." "What is your secret?" "To have assimilated all things so perfectly there is no longer any possibility of struggle. To have destroyed the idea of duality. To have achieved love and will, so there is no longer any object to love or any aim for will. To have killed desire at the root, to be one with everything and with nothing. Look," he went on with a change of tone, "why does a man die when he is struck by lightning? Because he has a gate open to lightning. He insists on being an electrical substance by possessing the quality of resistance to the passage of the electrical current. If we could diminish that resistance to zero, lightning would no longer take notice of him. There are two ways of preventing a rise of temperature from the sun's heat. One is to oppose a shield of non-conducting and opaque material. That is Cyril's way, and at the best it is imperfect. Some heat always gets through. The other is to remove every particle of matter from the space which you wish to be cold. Then there is nothing to become hot, and that is the way of the Tao. So that's just another sense of Crowley, and actually they're talking about this process that we've been looking at, this process of working with opposites and assimilating opposites, and of embracing everything that you find. So I can't obviously just in this brief time tell you everything there is about Crowley. So what I've tried to do is just give you some quotes, give you some ideas of things that people don't normally know about him. But also I hope just to sort of give a sense of why I think he's worth bothering with. Because these ideas, you know, the man is of no importance now. He's long time dead before any of us were born. But there's something in these ideas that link, that certainly speak to me here and now, but also link to things the ancient Egyptians were saying. And for that reason, there is value in them. So anyway, that's about all I guess I have to say on the subject. If anybody got any actual questions just before we finish? We need to finish shortly because we're a bit past time, but if anybody's with any burning kind of question about what I've just been talking about, I'll try and answer it.
We're all muted as well.
You'll have to unmute yourselves if you want to talk, because you're all on mute at the moment. So just unmute yourself and then say if you've got something you want to say.
I'm going to have to go, guys.
Bye-bye, Regan.
Bye, Regan.
Take care.
Bye. Good rest.
I'm just amazed what came out of that with the meeting of the water in that place of what that life. And
yeah.
And he was also saying, I will be done, kind of.
Yeah, that's right. Totally, yeah.
So it's something quite extraordinarily powerful in that. I'm losing my words, but
yeah.
No, I like
the miracle that we're all this. That's what we all are.
Yeah.
Is that thing?
Yeah.
That meeting of the where the we're the thing where the water meets the air.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
That's us.
Yeah, that's right.
And like where every man and woman is a star, and if we all do our own will,
yes,
there will be harmony.
Yeah, you know? That's right. Yes, that's the same idea as having your own allotment in the duet, right? Exactly the same idea. Cultivating your own garden, in that sense.
Mm. But I also like the way he's gone down to basics. He's looking at maths, he's looking at
yes, exactly.
Lines,
that's right.
He's looking at...
Yeah.
He's, you know, looked at Taoism. He's really researched all different ways, or to you know, another reality which he feels intrinsically is there, and that, and I like that, because I feel I've done a lot of that in my life. I've gone around, and, you know, and having found this and found how true it is, but at the same time. You know, hopefully it's because also I'm seeing the reflection of other things that I've done and been.
Yes, exactly.
Where you were talking, Rob, about, you know, perhaps, you know, nothing is wasted.
Yeah, totally. You know. Absolutely so, yeah.
Another thing that's come, thy will be done can also be my will be done.
Yes, it is, yeah.
My will be done.
Now, one of his great contemplations is the nature of the will, and what is the will, and when is the will deep will, and when it is fragmented will. So he speaks a lot about that, really, and that's important to territory here, really.
I think it's the only that really explains the difference between the active magician and the mystic, the mystical approach to differing forms of magic, different ways of dealing with energy and so on, you know, and the fact that Crowley clearly thought he was both people. Yeah. You know, it was all him. Every man was him in his books.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah.
And this one of being a human being rather than a human doing and having worked on yourself is infinitely superior, he seems to be saying.
Well, that's what he's saying, yes. He's basically saying the way of the Tao is a superior way to the way of manipulation, you know, because when he's talking about magic, he's talking about imposing will. He's talking about making people do things, whereas so the way of the Tao is the complete opposite of that somewhere.
Yeah.
I do believe, I've read lots of his stuff and stuff about him since I was quite young. And I don't think he's this perfect person
I know, far from it. Yeah.
Don't sort of have personality cult attachment to him. But I do believe he was as a human being, that his quest was to understand love, the power of love in the universe. And he didn't do that in that sort of pretty way of that we get even nowadays, that it's all nice and light and easy and open. He did it in
Yeah.
I have to go as well.
Okay, my lovely. Okay.
Bye,
Fern.
Thank you.
Take care. I just want to say something. I can see and I have read things by him that are very profound, especially in terms of when I was interested in like natural magic and things that he wrote about nature and I saw that, but I can see from what you said why it presses my bones.
Okay, so what is it then?
But it's my own kind of wounding and the places I've been wounded, I see he has wounded and I'm offended or I've got some reaction to him.
Because of things you've read about him, Faye, or because I'm not quite getting it.
I'd have to go into it all, which...
Okay, no, I don't want... Obviously, it's still not time to do that in that sense.
No, we haven't got time to do okay. that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I don't... It's a kind of deep thing, I suppose, but he's pressing my buttons, and maybe I've got to sit with the kind of... He has said profound things, but he's also done things that are not good. And somehow sitting with the two, because he's a human being, he's not a perfect being. I don't know how much to go into it, but
well, there's also a question really about how much you need to go into him anyway, right? So again, we're just to come back to this idea of that which is ours to work on and that which is not. So you'd only
if we're working with this tarot in the course, then I've kind of got to.
You're going to come up in
energy, and I'm sensitive to whatever he's put in that, and in some way it is affecting me through looking at the images, I think.
Well, yes, that I guess that's right, but we're not just, you know, if this were a course just on the Thoth Tarot, then it would be completely unavoidable. They will come up from time to time because they're one of the tools I'm using, but they're not the only things we're doing. And you've got a right, in a way, if you wish, to position yourself in such a way that, so if I do an exercise like that, you might decide not to do that exercise.
Right.
You know, Chris, quite legitimately, because actually it brings you into something that is maybe upsetting or not good for you, and it's
perfect. Maybe I need to see that, and actually it's healing something, and I'm seeing something, and I'm somehow needing to not demonize something and come to a place of peace and understanding with it.
It could be, and I think we don't know which is which at the moment, do we? Right, so I think that's the open question, and I suppose it's, so that's just something to sit with, I think, really, and just see.
I suppose I just need to sit with that and contemplate it and work through it, and then see where I'm at.
Yeah.
Want to bring something just now, Faye?
I don't know. I don't know how much to go into it because we're near the end.
Well, pretty much at the end. I think it would leave you a bit exposed right at the end, if I'm honest.
Yeah, right. So maybe.
So I don't think it's something for
it,
now.
And if it's still present next time, I can maybe.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't want to go into all my stuff all the time.
That's
you
okay.
know, it's a group process. And
yeah, sure.
Could I maybe come in, and this might relate a little bit to what you're talking about, Kate? Ian, the bit where he says an adept or an inexperienced adept might have their ego displaced and be occupied by the beast, whatever it was.
Yeah.
I think for me that's the trigger or the alarm, if you like, that we are beginning to touch into such sort of deep energies that we, and obviously this is a very mixed group with people with a lot of experience and people with a lot less experience, but we might be sort of touching into things that are a little bit, basically we will be in that position of the inexperienced adept.
Well, that would be a danger, but I would hope to shield everybody from that danger, because actually I'm really aware of that, Duncan, that can happen to people, because you know it is one of the whole things about working with the deep imagination is that people can get out of their depths, and that's why I'm really encouraging people, and that's why this particular piece of work this weekend is about judging the things that are right for you to work with, and then having a barrier around the things that aren't. So for example, I'm not saying to say, right, you should work with the Thoth Tarot and that'll be good for you. I'm genuinely not sure if it's good for Faye to work with that or not. And the same would go for anybody else, really, you know. So it's because it's very important to judge the edge, really, about, you know, what is the work that can be done, and then what's the work you just say no to, you don't exist for me. And that's the really important piece. That's the containment. In a way, that is the containment of the alchemical vessel that enables us to do constructive work, and the rest of it we leave for another time or may never ever go there, really. You know, it's that. It's also that.
I do get that. And it also feels like, this is my feeling about astrology as well. It's like you enter a space almost in darkness, knowing there might be something there that you want to engage with, but also knowing that you can't really see all of it or even any of it. And so there's something about the thing that came up for me about Crowley was he claimed K2 was that Sherpa. He was in that fool card. He was a man that just was not in any way concerned about his own death, clearly, and so he was able to engage almost like wholeheartedly with all of that. This is supposition, this isn't fact.
I don't know, but
it's almost like the guy in the documentary Free Solo. I don't know if you've seen that. It's about a guy that free climbs mountains.
Okay.
They find that he's got an amygdala that doesn't function.
Yeah.
No fear function. And it's sort of like, for somebody that does have an amygdala that's maybe quite sensitive, like me, for example, there's a thing of, oh, we're going into somewhere that could get a little bit unheld and a little bit dangerous, essentially.
Well, I think that the problem with this kind of work is that I suppose that edge is always potentially there. But I guess it's my experience, as long as people aren't forced into things, and as long as we just do things in a sort of careful, step-by-step kind of way. Yes, I think you're right. If Crowley were leading this group, then that could be quite a danger. I'm not like Crowley. I don't have that self-destructive, full on kind of thing. You know, sort of. So I get to what you're saying, and I do acknowledge it is something. It is something that has to be considered. But I suppose over all the years of teaching this kind of work, I've never known anybody get into trouble with it as long as they were respecting their own sense of boundary. And I don't get a sense of anybody in this group who isn't doing that, actually. So I don't know that it's a major problem, Duncan.
No, and to be honest, I don't want to sound like I'm being alarmist and panic. I'm just sort of naming that something is there.
Yeah. No, I think you're naming something important, right? It's very important. You know, this is something part of this territory. I mean, Jung talks a lot about it, possession by an archetype, the disintegration of the psyche by being too deeply exposed to the energies of the collective unconscious. So, you're naming something that's real. And it's why it's actually why when people explore these things using drugs and things, sometimes they get in a shitload of trouble because the conscious defenses get knocked out. Yeah. As long as we're respecting our defenses and we're doing it step by step, it should be fine. Yeah. It will
also
be fine.
The fact that we're held so beautifully throughout with the structures, with the light, with the Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic cross and the middle pillar before we even enter into the territory. That gives a feeling of safety for me before, even embarking on the deeper work.
I think that's absolutely right. That is the reason for using those exercises. It's also the reason for really coming back to the body. The body is, so the whole idea of approaching the imaginal, the danger is splitting and fragmenting. So this sense of coming always back to the body, always back to the felt sense, working with the energy exercises that promote energetic and physical coherence are really helpful, as Pam has just said, really. So I think that's kind of important as well.
I think that was the problem with Crowley, though. I mean, because what is his legacy? It's the chaos magicians, and I mean they're all out there presumably trying to touch the edges and the destructive aspect, which is not where we're going at all.
No, I mean, I think that's the point. I mean, certainly there are lots of people who are sort of psychonauts who get themselves into trouble because they don't work with shape, they don't work with boundary, they don't work with containment. And that's, and truthfully, lots of therapists can get in trouble like that as well. If you look at, there's lots of examples. If you look at EST, there's various self-help things where people get into enormous trouble for exactly the same reasons. That kind of hubris and overriding the natural sense of boundary.
Mm.
Sorry, just to jump in, I've been reading so much about EST in the last couple of weeks, and exactly Werner Erhard's thing of overriding boundaries is exactly the territory.
It's massively the territory because they deliberately confronted people in confined circumstances and produced all kinds of cathartic reactions, which sometimes people experienced as good in the moment, but did of course lasting damage because they had disarranged the psyche.
Yeah.
Totally disagree. As somebody's gone through this one of those weekends.
Yeah.
What's EST, please?
It's something
training.
I don't remember the term. It's just.
They're dreadful. Yeah. Mm. I just found it fascinating. The confront, and I just thought this is really funny, and I just watched myself go into all this spasm and stuff, and I just was amused because I could step back and watch myself doing it. I didn't see it as damaging. I just thought, how interesting, they're playing this game with us.
That gives you the ability to be aware of that.
Yeah.
Without that, the ability to sort of have self-awareness, it's just chaos. It is just chaos, because all it is somebody triggering all of your stuff and people floundering.
Anybody, and I was involved in a group for a couple of years. I never came across anybody who'd actually had any breakdown or anything. It wasn't EST, it was something slightly different. Yeah.
I had a relative go through this. They did them no good whatsoever, and I think it's damaged them. But the thing is, we're in the opposite of that, because we've chosen an ethical teacher who we've been around for years. We're in a contained group. We're invited always
to do what is right for us, which is a real trigger thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, if someone says, oh, don't worry about that, just do as I say, then alarm bells would ring. So we couldn't really be held. And then, as Pam said, we have all these